Hello, and welcome to Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to break the taboos around death and dying and learn to talk about it. Thank you if you've been listening since the beginning, and if you have, you'll know we've covered so many aspects of death and dying, from what it's actually like to die, to how it feels to lose your nearest and dearest, the different ways grief can strike, the different ways we cope or don't with loss, how counselling can help, what part faith can play, how to help others going through grief, and how to pick up the pieces and rebuild a life after a big loss. I'm joined now by Victoria Kibble of Lodge Brothers, and we're going to talk more about death and dying, obviously, because that's the point of this podcast. And I know you've had quite a bit to do with it over your career, haven't you, Victoria?
I absolutely have, yes. Not just in Lodge Brothers, but in my previous role in the NHS.
Would you like to tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, so I was a pediatry assistant, used to have to go into people's houses, and I was quite stricken, I suppose, by you would attend 1 minute, and 3 months later you'd go back, and the house is very different. And then you suddenly realise it's because, although you're there for one person, their partner has now died and their house looks different because all the medical equipment's gone. And they're sat, staring at you, pleased that you're there talking to them, probably the only person they've seen in a long time because their friends and family have just gone. They've left them to it now. You might have found yourself that sometimes friends and family, they're there for the funeral. We think it's usually between 2 and 4 weeks after, that's when the support stops. Because for everybody else, their life keeps going. But for you, you're stuck in this very new life, and it takes a long time to adjust. You certainly can't tell somebody it's going to take a month, 6 months, because it's very, very different for everybody.
So you seem to be suggesting that there are a lot of people out there who are bereaved and then kind of left alone.
Yes.
Abandoned in a sense.
Hugely. And I think if you were to ask our funeral arrangers, one thing they find is they see a lot of people that come to make an arrangement on their own. Well, the person that's with them, it's not always a family member, it's often a friend. Or they do the first phone call on their own. Because no one else has given them the support, no one else has said to them what they're supposed to do. We will often ask families, have you had to arrange a funeral before? And when they say no, we like to quickly prompt that with, that's really good, I'm really pleased that you've not had to. But sadly, we're now in this position and we're going to have to help you the best we can, offer you whatever support we can.
We all get there at some point in our lives, don't we? And it's usually a big shock when we find ourselves arranging our first ever funeral.
Even if you knew it was coming. Nobody wants to admit these things are happening. And I think, having dealt with it personally myself, I think you kind of live in the moment, don't you? And you kind of think, okay, well, I'm just going to deal with this day to day. I worry about the other stuff if, when it happens. And all of a sudden, wham, it has now arrived.
And I know that since you've been with Lodge Brothers, you've organised a lot of funerals.
Oh, yes.
I gather you
can. Quite a few.
Tell me about the variety.
I'm slightly different in as much as I will very much listen to somebody and give them exactly what they want, but I add a bit of extra something, a bit of extra flair. And I've got a good way of listening and engaging very quickly what somebody's character's like. Now, it is never, should never be a funeral arranger's position to influence a funeral. If a family want traditional, then that's what they're going to have, absolutely. But there is all different ways you can just bespoke so that everybody that's attending kind of gets a real feel of that person. It could be something really basic as, you know, they were into knitting. And I've done this several times. I'm a bit of a knitter, where I've made these sort of almost pom-pom style knitting balls that go into the floral tributes. We have order of service filled with knitting on the front. We've had somebody's own handmade blanket placed over the coffin, and then they go with it, so they're tucked in with it because they spent a lot of time and effort. But I think possibly the best funeral that I've arranged, I was quite new into the business, and I had two gentlemen come and see me to arrange for Dad's funeral. Now, their father had been on a submarine in his younger years. So I said, that's fine. I said, and they had a real good character about them. They had a real good personality. They were quite funny gentlemen. one took everything a little more seriously than the other, so I knew I had to be quite careful what I did. But both sat there and said, oh, it would be quite fun, wouldn't it, if his coffin was a submarine? And they just giggled and laughed. And I said, huh, you know, I can do that for you. We have a company that vinyl wrap them. Yeah, but will it really look like one? Now I'm, you know, Blue Peter age. So already I'm thinking, oh, I could do something here. So I made them a periscope.
Wow.
Everybody in the office thought I had actually lost my marbles. Our workshop was like, what are you doing now? But no, made the periscope. I thought, well, I could leave it there, or I could ring the maritime guys up down in Portsmouth. And I actually managed to get a recording of a control centre. I liaised with my conductor. So as they carried Dad in, it went, and forgive me, I don't know the exact terminology because it was many years ago, but it went along the lines of command to control, over, receiving, go ahead, dive when ready. And it had the sonar. And as they said the word dive, 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 he was lowered onto the catafalque. Everybody stood up and gave that gentleman a round of applause. Now, I knew I wouldn't have overstepped the mark because we'd had these wonderful chats with this family. Everybody thought I'd done the wrong thing. Everybody said, you've gone too far. This is just going to look tacky. But the family were thrilled to bits. They couldn't believe that one person had listened that much and gone over and above for what they were doing. But yeah, I'll make anything. And because we're a team, actually, sometimes we'll just have a coloured tie. That works a treat. You know, we want a very traditional funeral. Absolutely. Oh, but Mum really had a thing for cerise pink. We've got ties. So it's just that gentle nod. And that's what I was saying earlier. You know, sometimes it's just the small things, not the big, wild and wonderful.
Can you think of some more wild and wonderful, though, to tell us?
Yeah, so flowers is a huge thing. Some people will go all out. And I was at a cemetery only yesterday, actually, and the flower, I can't reach the top of the flowers. Now, I'm 5'5". So my arms up, I'm over 6 foot, and I could not reach the top of these flowers. And they are all of everything that this lady loved. They've got her favourite television programme. So there's a television made out of flowers. We did the funeral. There was her pets. So there's a big dog, there's a big cat. You know, there's all these different things. You think that's pretty cool, isn't it? Because it's a way of actually then showing everybody else that might visit that place a little snippet of history of their loved one. So I like that quite a bit. We did quite a few horse drawings, and people don't realise that with horses, you can have different colour horses, you can have different colour carriages. The company that we use, they actually have got original wooden carriages. So back when the wars were all kicking off, wood was seen as a commodity. So most carriages were broken down, but they've got two that were saved, restored. And so we go out, and these wheels are absolutely ginormous. You can't get your arms around them. A black one, a white one. And it's quite interesting. Some people will choose to have the horses match the carriages. Other people don't. Some people choose to have plumes on the horses and covers over the horses to match like that feel. Like I was saying about the ties, they do it, but with the horses instead. Two horses, four horses, it depends. We've got a few people where they say they want a horse drawn, but actually money is an issue, and we absolutely need to respect that. So we delve in a bit deeper, and we had a lady who, not dissimilar, I suppose, to the Queen, who had her own horse waiting for her. But we had a lady where we went past the stables, and they had got, I think we had about five horses all ready to go, and those horses led us down the road.
Oh, how lovely. So they didn't cost as much as having
They didn't cost anything because they were her own friend's horses.
Oh.
So those horses were in front of our hearse. She got her cortege with her horses that she had been looking after and known for years. And that is often more beautiful than going big and crazy, isn't it? We've had the Hummer hearses. They are massive.
I didn't know they existed.
No, I didn't until we had an order for three of them. Absolutely massive, massive things. And then we've got to try and struggle down some of these lovely country roads and think, yeah, this isn't going to work. Can I have to meet you at the end of the road, please? We've had a lady came to me and had said that her husband was massively into aircraft. Spent many a year at Dunsfold. The Vulcan, he had seen the Vulcan plane fly. I had too, because I'd been to Goodwood a few years beforehand. So that was great because we had something that we could talk about. So what do we do? Well, we just got the recording. The Vulcan plane makes such a noise, it rattles your bones. And we had that play. So as he went through, that was playing. You just watched her, everything during that service, she just knew it was coming. That was a really good release for her. But afterwards, we helped her talk to a company that will put you and your ashes in a Spitfire.
Gosh.
So off you fly, out they go. And she said that's the one thing he would have loved the most. I know that Cressa was talking to a drone company that will take your ashes up and scatter them over a larger area nowadays. So it's not just the funeral, it's all the other things that we can do afterwards. Lots of people might just choose to scatter, and so we split ashes quite a bit. But for other people, we fully appreciate that's a bit too much. They want their person to stay in one hole. Not a problem.
So when you say split ashes, you mean give them little different containers, yes, so they can give them to different members of the family or something like that?
Yeah, or they take them to different places around the country, around the world, that meant something to that person, meant something to them as a family. Lots of people are choosing jewellery nowadays. So they're having the ashes put into something so they can keep it on their person at all times. Again, we won't judge you. We'll do whatever it is that's going to help you go through that grieving process. And you never know, but there might be a day where you take off that ring and you think, I don't want to wear it anymore. But until that day comes, it's there giving you comfort, isn't it?
What are the rules around scattering of ashes? Because I don't think any of us know whether we can just go out into the countryside and do it wherever we want.
No. So golf clubs often say no. And I know that lots of people decide to do the Great Escape and it's just a quick shuffle over here and a shuffle over there. So I think if we were really looking at it, there is probably a lot of people scattered in a lot of places that they shouldn't be. But today it's not caused any harm, has it? We've got to be really mindful, I suppose. Also, we've got some religious connotations. So we'll find that lots of people need to have their water returned back to, that sorry, their ashes returned back to water. I don't know if you know of something called mudlarking. So up in London, you can traipse along when the tide is out. You can traipse along that muddy verge and they're finding all kinds of things. And they will always say, oh, we found another urn. Yep. It's because a lot of people will wander up to London Bridge. Over they go, because it's part of London. Forgetting that actually an urn will sink pretty quickly, get trapped in the mud, and that's where they stay. But for some people, as I say, religious, it's all about going back, being cleansed, putting into the water, so people will be scattered into water. Lots of companies will take you out on a boat and scatter you in certain places in the sea, sort of down by, you know, the coast. It's gorgeous. We've had bodies at sea, burials at sea. They take quite a while because we have to be really mindful. We have to be in touch with quite a few of the coastal agencies. We have to know exactly what day we're allowed out, weather permitting. There is a certain spot that we have to go to. Only a certain amount of people can physically get on the boat. They're quite fascinating. We haven't done one of those for a while, but we have done a fair few while I've been here.
So you've covered land, sea and air?
We have, yes.
Anything else?
I don't think there is anywhere else, is there? No.
And do you find most people nowadays go for a cremation?
Yes.
Rather than a burial?
Yes. We've only got an infinite amount of space, haven't we? It's kind of a different way to look at it, I suppose. Some people choose to have a burial because that's where they've lived their whole life. It makes sense that they don't leave that place. And I get that. It's somewhere they can go. That's their spot of remembrance. Some people take comfort in talking to their loved one's grave. Absolutely fine. Other people can't cope with that and need to know that actually they're still really close to them on the mantelpiece, in a cupboard, shared amongst the family. Either way, it's not a problem. It's whatever suits you. And we do have a lot of people that will have somebody cremated. It is a lesser cost, and inter the ashes later. Some people in a partnership will say, well, look, whoever goes first, I'm going to be cremated so I can then go with you. That's really important that I'm with you wholly, whether scattered together, mixed, or just placed side by side. Again, not a problem. We find that people move quite a bit. So, you know, there is a bit of a myth, it used to be, that if you pass through a council, you have to pay. I don't know if you ever heard that. Lots of people will say to me, oh, because we're going through a couple of councils and boroughs, do we have to pay anything? And I think, where's that from? So I was asking my nan, and it's back in her time. You know, right back when you used to have to pay to come through, and it must go back to ridiculous age.
The border of the county you're talking about.
That doesn't exist anymore. But what happens is, should you live in a borough and pay your council tax to that borough, you have the right to be buried in their cemetery. If you don't live there and you still desperately want to get in, it's deemed as you're taking away a residence plot. So therefore they charge you usually 3 times the amount to purchase the grave and 3 times the amount to be interred into that grave.
Gosh.
Mm. That council has the right to say no to you if there's no real reason for you being in there, or you've got no family that are going to be in there as well. That can cause quite a lot of stress to our families because, you know, they might have granddad, grandma in there. They now want mum or dad to go in. And actually, sometimes, sadly, due to water tables, we can't have a burial for 3 people anymore. We can only dig to 2 depths. Again, it's all the small things that the layperson isn't going to even think twice about, are they? We're then left to explain to a family what they can and can't have, and often we often get quite a bit of their frustration.
You make some interesting points there about people moving a lot, mm-hmm. because, of course, if you do bury somebody and then you move away several times, then that rather defeats the object, doesn't it, of having somebody...
Yes. We do exhumations as well. However, they are not to be taken lightly. If somebody has been buried in consecrated ground, which means it's been blessed by the diocese, then you have to apply for a very specific faculty, and the judge may quite rightly say, no, there is no reason to do so. If you're just moving for moving's sake, or because actually you just don't like the area that you've been placed in, you've not really got a chance. I've been part of a few exhumations now, and they're quite tough. They're quite tough on the family. For us, we deal with memorials as well, and we find that a grave is often left without a stone for quite a few years. Lots of people think, oh, right, okay, buried, stone will be on in a couple of weeks. Absolutely not. You've got to wait for the ground to settle. You're looking at a year. Then you've got to think about what you want, and that is the most final part of the funeral, isn't it? That stone will be there long after us. It's got to be right. So people quite rightly take a lot of time. Are you then going to move that person and all that stone? Chances are you're not. And that's why, if you go to most cemeteries now, you see lots of dilapidated, as a word I can't clearly say, graveyards, because people have moved on, or the families have died out and no one's there to care for them. If you purchase the grave, you purchase it for X amount of years. Some it's 25 years, some it's 100 years. You are responsible for keeping that grave looking as it should. Yes, the maintenance crews at the cemetery will come through with the lawnmower, but they don't touch your grave. So it's down to you. Once the lease or the purchase for that grave lease has finished, the cemetery take it back. The cemetery aren't going to reopen that grave unless they absolutely have to. And it's a long process. They can't just reopen, they can't just announce they just need that grave. No. They have to go through national newspapers, they have to try and find family to see if anybody else wants to take it on. It's a lot of time and cost. So when people say a burial is really expensive, well, it is, but actually if you think how much you're paying divided over the amount of years that you lease that grave, and knowing that realistically no one's going to be allowed to touch it for, let's say, 100 years, all of a sudden the cost is quite nominal, isn't it? But again, I wouldn't expect the everyday person to give that a blink of a thought.
I suppose it all goes back to the olden days when people didn't move around very much, did they? And they got buried locally.
And you had a family plot.
Yes, and you all got buried close to each other and right. Somewhere where people would visit. And mm-hmm. Now things have just changed dramatically, haven't they?
Absolutely.
And I've heard from different people when I've been doing this podcast, some people who like to visit the grave because it gives them solace, other people who actively don't want to. Mm-hmm. And then another, I remember... it was Rabbi Jonathan Romaine, who I've talked to recently, who thought he would go and visit his son's grave because it was nearby to where he lived, and actually found he never did because he felt he was carrying his son with him in his heart.
That makes a lot of sense. That does. I have had to conduct quite a few children's funerals. One, which will always stay in my mind, we had 2 children that died within a month of each other at the same school, one who was very poorly and one was completely unexpected. So we had over 300 people attend at each funeral, and children came. And it was really important for me to get the children sort of up front, because It was their friend. Yes, the parents were grieving, but actually they didn't understand that the children would grieve in a very different way. They're very, very hard-wearing children. They're much more astute, and they're on the ball more than I think adults give them credit for. But mum and dad turned up dressed in Harry Potter cloaks. And I thought, yes, here we go. Because they weren't trying to be funny. It's just they knew that was the kind of life that had been celebrated. And sometimes when we hand back children's ashes, families are very quick to take them. Then the panic sets in. Now what do I do with them? Because every month more that I'm looking at them, it's that reminder. And do I wait for me? Or do I put them somewhere and risk forgetting about them? It's, you know, there's so much to think about. But as I said right at the beginning, that's a personal thing. You know, no one should be allowed to say what to do, how to do it, how long it should take you. When a friend of mine's husband died unexpectedly, she cried for months and months. And I will give you a tip. She used a soft flannel. She always had a soft flannel on her. It's one that it's called Erase Your Face. They're great. They're quite feely. Because she said the tissues were making her eyes really red, but the flannel, she could get away with it. It would dry off the tears. Didn't leave a mark. Everyone thought she was okay.
Oh.
But she would cry constantly. And I said to her, what do you want to do? Can I do anything? What do you want to do? She said, I don't know. She said, I probably should start looking at getting rid of his clothes. And I said, why? That's a really good point. I don't know why. So she didn't. 3 years on, yes, she has now, but took her that time. You know, it's a very personal thing, isn't it?
Different ways for different people.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. What has been the most difficult funeral you've had to take or be involved in?
There's difficult in different ways. So we, very sadly, we deal with a lot of families where there's conflict. It could be that one sibling has felt responsible for looking after mum or dad. They might have been invited into their home. They've been caring for them on a very, very physical basis for a long time, with another sibling nowhere near. Funeral happens, all of a sudden, said sibling now wants to know everything, wants to be highly involved, disagrees with everything. And I conduct funerals as well. And it's, you spot that a mile off, you can just see. And it's all about trying to get this family to realise that we're not here for them. All of that nonsense needs to wait, because we're here for mum or dad. We're here for celebrating that life, remembering all the good. And you know what? That person still brought two of you into this world. So come on, guys. So that can be quite difficult, especially when our arrangers get so many phone calls, and death is very emotive. People can get very angry, and they can spill that anger onto the wrong people. But we're a pretty hard bunch. We get back up, keep smiling. We understand it's a very short time that they're going to be cross with us for, and we move on. I often find some of the harder funerals are those where somebody has lived to sort of 90, 100, 100 plus. I took a funeral for a 104-year-old, and the eulogy got me hard because I was absolutely blown away with all the stuff that this gent had done. You know, the amount of work he had been involved in, the amount of friends that he had seen come and go, had lived in the house his entire life, was born in said house, and you think, hang on, what? This is mad. We also, we sadly had a family where the deceased had been really poorly, really, really poorly, and she was a very horsey lady. And she was at the point where she had to walk away from the stables because she physically was in hospital, couldn't get down to there. And her horse suffered. Her horse started to grieve for her. The family were telling me that when she felt strong enough, they would put her in a wheelchair, take her down, and her horse would run across. I was just elated. She would then go back to hospital or back home, and a couple of weeks would pass, and the horse pined. Horse got very sick, and she had to make that decision to have the horse put down. And she died no later than 2 weeks after. And they are adamant it's because she and the horse were grieving for each other. The day of that funeral was the first time I've actually cried at a funeral, because the husband stood there and in his eulogy had said, my darling Sam, I hope when I finally see you, the three of us will be back together and I might be allowed in. And I just thought, oh, wow, because he knows how much that horse meant. Now, the family had asked that the horse's ashes could be with her and that they could be mixed together. And it is strange because the horse's ashes, when I got them, they were so heavy. Oh, wow, does a horse give you a lot of ash back? Blimey. But they were so dark in comparison to a human. Now, I don't know why. Maybe it's a different process. I mean, it's not a different process, but I don't know what that was about. But the mixing of ashes was just something else because they almost went back to the same colour as the horse. He was a beautiful, beautiful kind of like mottled grey, and that's how we presented them back. But that was hard because you are brought into that family circle of trust, I suppose, and you're brought into that communication with the family, and you hear so many stories and they share with you all kinds of information that you just have to take in, let it dissolve and carry on. And that could be quite hard.
It's a very privileged role, really, isn't it?
Huge.
Getting to know these people so yes. well yes. at the end.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned myths earlier on. Mm. And I think the myth you were talking about was this business of paying to go from yes. borough to borough or county to yeah. county. But there must be lots of other myths around
oh, yes.
death and dying and burials and funerals.
People say to me all the time, how will I know that I'm dead? Well, there's a few just natural things that happen. Rigor mortis will set in. You know, we are not allowed to remove anybody until they've been verified by a healthcare practitioner, doctor, or a nurse that can. In all settings, whether that's a hospital, care home, or palliative care establishment, or your actual house, should the coroner be involved, then the police are there. Normally the London Ambulance Service has arrived as well. So, you know, we're pretty sure.
So people are actually worried that they might be carted off when yeah. they're not dead.
Yeah, and I get that. No, you want to, everything, you've got to be sure in life. You have to be sure in life. We are often asked, regularly asked, what's the point of a coffin? You're going to take me out of it anyway. And we absolutely won't. The rules of any crematoria, quite rightly, are you have to be placed and cremated in a suitable vessel. No getting around that. To open the doors of a cremator and to push a coffin in is quite tough. It's hot. And you have to be able to get a whole coffin into the furnace before ignition. If you were to do that without a coffin, you would get a bit of a backdraft, basically. So you have to have a coffin without fail. Has to have one. Checks are made. Checks are put in place all the time. Checks that we physically put on a deceased, on your loved one, a wristlet, an anklet, we know. If somebody has come into chapel, it's even better because we then know that they've seen their loved one. That's definitely the right person. Once you're in that coffin, it's yours. If you were to change your mind and say, I don't like that coffin, I want them in this other one, we dispose of that first coffin. Nobody else is allowed in it because it was measured and made for them. Nobody else. We would never put somebody in a second-hand one. The coffin plate has got a lid, and everyone, whether it's burial or cremation, will always insist on a name, full name, age, date of death, being on that lid for identification purposes. Because it's got to match the paperwork that we send, and it's got to match the wristlets, the anklets that we've got, so we know that is the right person. So no, your coffin is yours, right till the end. Some people will be unsure if the cremated remains are actually of their loved one. So we know, and you are allowed to go and see behind the scenes at a crematorium, as long as you've called up to give them advance warning. They'll guide you through. Lots of places actually do open days. Fascinating, because you get to see exactly what goes on. But short terms is you've got your plate, and there's a little card or a little identification chip that sits alongside that coffin. And whilst you're in the cremator, it sits on the outside as your ashes are taken down to be sifted through for any metals, whether it's jewellery fragments that you've asked for back, or whether it's hip bones or, you know, sort of medical, surgical metals, they all get taken out. They actually get recycled. So each crematoria will send them off any monies that they receive for weighing in their metals, all goes to charity, which is really nice. But again, that card follows you through each part of the cremations process. When we then get the person back in their cardboard casket, they're in a bag that's been labelled, in a box that is also labelled, with a certificate that's labelled. And our first job is to check that all three things match. So we are content that that is who they should be. We then show that to the family. A bit of a taboo subject, I suppose, really, is the dignified funerals, the ones where you can just pay to have nobody in attendance. Lots of people don't realise how far away you go for that. That you may well be in a private ambulance with four other people for your whole journey. We choose not to do it that way. Each person is still in a coffin that is taken by a hearse, because that's how we feel it. We would like it done. That's the dignity and respect we would do. We know that lots of other funeral directors feel exactly the same way as us. But it doesn't always fit everyone, does it?
Because we're recording it today, and because we've recently heard of a scandal about this, I think your explanation has been wonderful, because you make it very clear what strict controls you place over all the ashes to be sure they are the right person.
So we are then looked after. We've got an umbrella group called the National Association of Funeral Directors, and we are part of that group. So therefore, they will come around and inspect us too and check, are your cremation remains in a locked cupboard? Where do you hold your deceased? How do you hold your deceased? We actually work with coroners as well. We hold coroners contracts. So we work on behalf of them. We take our Lodge Brothers hat off and we work for them. Should there be an unexpected death in the community, we go out and remove that person into the care of the coroner. So quite rightly, they need to know how we look after our deceased, both on our site and what we're doing when we're transferring them into their care. It's unusual. What has happened in Hull is not the norm. We work closely with other funeral directors. Funeral directors all know each other. It's, you know, you have to, because sometimes you might need to ring them up and say, "Oh, my limousine's broken down, help us out." And you do. Predominantly, they've all set up at one point from being family-run businesses. So it made sense that we all have a community together. We do notice there's a lot more independent funeral directors popping up here, there and everywhere that don't have the facilities, that perhaps they're working out of a house or just an office block, and then they're using other funeral directors to look after their loved ones. I can't speak for them. If it works for them, great, as long as the care and due diligence over their deceased is there. And you're allowed to shop around.
Mm.
Yes, we know that people come to us through reputation, but we also have a lot of people that walk in and we know full well they've been somewhere else. It's not a problem. And if they talk to us and they say, "Oh, but, you know, we know that castings and stuff." Listen, go online. Everyone now, the Competitive Markets Authority very much said that funeral directors have to start publicising their fees. Quite right too. Why shouldn't you, for something as serious as this? Why shouldn't you look around? Sometimes money does equal level of service, but you should be able to walk into any funeral directors and you should be able to ask to see their chapel. You should be able to ask that arranger, "How do you look after my loved one?" And if they can't tell you, I think I'd be walking out.
Thank you ever so much, Victoria. It's been lovely talking to you. And I can understand how your customers go away with a smile on their face, because you're making it seem that, okay, it is a very serious subject, but it's not all doom and gloom. And let's make the most of it. Thank you ever so much for talking to me.
No, well, I want this podcast, all of your podcasts, to go well. And if people take one thing away, it's just get a little bit of paper. Put down a couple of things. Not necessarily all about what you want at your funeral, but what sums up you.
Let's hope keeping on talking about death and dying and funerals and everything else helps.
Absolutely.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on
hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.